Good morning. You know what? I forgot to get jokes from my daughter. She was spending the night at someone's house, so I'm not going to be able to amuse you as much. We are going to go through Judges chapter 17 and 18 this morning. I took over for Pastor Bill for one night of home fellowship. We did Judges chapter 3. And I like the book of Judges. It's got a lot of cool stories in it. And ironically, I think it also pictures the U.S. pretty good as to where we are in our spiritual walk as far as basically how the whole tribe of Israel is. It follows God. It walks away from God. It realizes, oh, I made a mistake, comes back to God. And we are at a point right now where we are not following as we should. We are doing things that we think are right in our own eyes. So, we are in Judges chapter 17. Let me turn there real quick. Okay. So, Judges 17 and 18 are basically a case study in the idolatry of the nation of Israel. The whole book basically talks about judges, how Israel fell into sin. A judge would come along after Israel cried out to God for help and basically redeem them, give them salvation from the enemy they were enslaved to. And then that person would reign for 40, 80 years, and they would have salvation and peace for that time. Now, they had all general examples of how they fell into sin, and then we get specific examples in 17, 18, and 19 as to things that were going on during that time that represent how everybody was acting. Now, like I said, the mantra for these chapters, or as for the book, is mentioned in verse 6 of actually this chapter, and it is, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, before I get into that, idolatry itself is the excessive devotion to or reverence for someone other than God, basically. It doesn't need to be necessarily a fashioning of an idol with your hands. Idolatry, in its essence, is a god to suit yourself that you create in your own heart. So you don't fashion it with your hands. It's something you can fashion with your heart. Let me read verses 1 through 6 for you. Now a man named Micah from the hill country of Ephraim said to his mother, 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you, and about which I heard you utter a curse. I have that silver with me. I took it. Then his mother said, the Lord bless you, my son. When he returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother, she said, I solemnly consecrate my silver to the Lord for my son to make an image overlaid with silver. I will give it back to you. So after he returned the silver to his mother, she took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to a silversmith, who used them to make an idol, and it was put in Micah's house. Now this man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and some household gods, and installed one of his sons as his priest. And in verse 6, in those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit, or as they saw was right in their own eyes. Now let me give you a synopsis. Micah has basically stolen from his mother 1,100 shekels of silver, and that is a huge amount. It's probably years and years of wages. They would probably be thousandaires, at least, according to our estimation today. Now, he hears her utter a curse against it. And curses back then, you know, when we curse somebody today, we're like, ha-ha, that's funny. It doesn't really mean anything to us. But back then, it was, oh, the fear of God was, I don't want that curse to come on me or my family. So he hears it, and he goes, okay, I'm going to confess, Mom, it was me. Here, you can have it back. So you get the impression, sort of, that this guy was a mama's boy, and not that there's anything wrong with that, because I am. But his mom basically tries to revoke the curse and says, okay, well, I'm going to bless you, my son. Thank you for returning it. Good job. And then she gives it to him anyway. Now, when she gives it back to him, she basically says, I'm going to dedicate this to the Lord, and I'm going to give you an idol. And so what she does is she takes 200 shekels of that, and she gives it to him. Now, the NIV isn't as clear on this specific point, but she actually gives him some for a molded image, which is basically you take silver and you make it soft enough and you shape it how you want to shape it. An idol itself is, it's like a wood or a stone or something, and then it's overlaid with the silver or gold or whatever precious metal. So she actually gives him two different items to dedicate to God. Now we find out that Micah himself takes these idols and places them in his house, where he actually already has idols set up. He's got his own shrine. He's got his own fake priestly garments. He's got all these things. And he sets his own son up as priest. Now, it's not always the case. In fact, it doesn't have to be the case at all. But idolatry itself, it always starts with us. We don't need our parents to set an example for us. It says in Romans that none seeks after God. We all seek after idols naturally. That's our natural state. But it doesn't help that the mother here does not correct her son in what he's doing. Now, I'm not trying to be nitpicky, because I don't consider myself a perfect parent at all. But the first thing I notice about the mother is that she doesn't issue any correction. She didn't say, oh, you did a bad thing, you know. She didn't give him a lecture or anything at all. She just corrects him by blessing him so the curse doesn't get on him. She doesn't tell him that what he did is not pleasing to God. She rewards his theft. She rewards his sin by giving him the silver. Now, the second thing I notice is she's not actually a woman of her word. She said she was going to bless that all 1,100 shekels of silver to her son, to the Lord to give to her son, and she gives 200, which is basically less than a fifth of what she said. And then thirdly, she encourages her son to make idols. She's encouraging him to break the second commandment. Now, like I said, I don't want to seem nitpicky, and there is idols that we have in our life. Now, in their day and age, it was these fashion things, and because they were in Canaan, they conquered Canaan for the most part, but they left some of the tribes, so they had this tribal influence. Now, some examples today of idolatry, and I'm going to use myself because I'm the perfect guinea pig. And idols are different for everybody. I don't know if you guys watch sci-fi, and I don't watch it as much as I used to because that's not an idol for me anymore. But, and not that you can't watch sci-fi, but I like B-movies. They're the cheesy, stupid monster movies. And they're dumb. And I like them. I think they're funny. And I will watch Super Croc. And I will watch Sharknado. Because they're funny. And there have been times in the past where I was like, oh, I should study the Bible. But Super Croc is on. And I might turn my heart towards that. And it might be an idol for that day. There are other times where food is an idol for some people. And not all food is something that tempts me. But there's this one kind of pie, and I really love it. And it's not a fruit pie. And it's not even chocolate pie, and I love chocolate. But it's pumpkin pie. And I love pumpkin pie. And I love that Costco makes it 5 months out of the year. Because I can have it 5 months out of the year. In fact, it is so powerful sometimes against me that I looked up in the computer to see how many I had bought in a year's time. And in a year's period, I had bought 22 pumpkin pies. And I didn't buy them from my family. When I would go to lunch, I'd go, oh, I didn't bring lunch. I guess I'm going to have to buy pie. So I would buy pie. And I would eat two-thirds of it for lunch. And I didn't bring the rest home to my family. I brought it home, put it in the fridge, and I ate it for breakfast. But, no, not all 22 did I just buy for myself. There were at least five that were for the family. But I really love pumpkin pie. And people at work know this because they'll go, hey, Aaron, I guess we started making last week. And they told me this last night. Or actually, he said yesterday. We started making pumpkin pie yesterday. And so, anyway, there are little things like that. And it doesn't seem like a big deal, but when it's there, and I go, oh, I really got to have pumpkin pie. Oh, I'm really craving this. But, and my excuse was, well, it's a vegetable, and that's how I eat my vegetables. But those things can have a damaging effect. Now, I used to, and most of my work at Costco is done in the morning. I'm usually up before most people are. Typically right now I get up at 2:30 so I can be at work at 4. And it's very hard to get up without caffeine. And when I first started working in the mornings, I would drink Red Bull. And I was like, Red Bull's bad for me. I'll drink Mountain Dew because that was so much better. So I was like, Mountain Dew's bad. So I was looking for something else. And I'm like, 5-Hour, that's got vitamins. So I'm going to justify it that way. And I did for many, many years. And I realized how bad it really was for me. And not the vitamins, but the caffeine itself. One little bottle has enough caffeine as one cup of coffee. I'm not saying you can't drink coffee. But I went to a clinic because I was like, I want to donate plasma. And you have to have a physical beforehand, and they test you to make sure that your plasma's okay. So the nurse has given me a physical, and she's listening to my heart. She goes, you know you have a heart arrhythmia? I said, no. I had a physical less than a year ago. I didn't have a heart arrhythmia. She's all, okay, well, that probably means it's not genetic. And she's asking me questions to figure out where it came from. She's all, do you drink a lot of coffee? I said, no. And then with dramatic pause, I said, but I do drink 5-Hour. And she's all, that's probably it. I can't let you donate until I get this cleared by the doctor. And I went, I said, well, he doesn't have to wake up at 2. He doesn't understand. And so I went home, and I'm going, on the drive home, I'm like, I got to give this up. I said, I don't want to give this up. I like the instant awake that it gives me. I don't like to drudge through the morning. And finally, I was like, okay, this really has a hold on me. I need to let it go. So I had, I think, 8 bottles of 5-Hour left. I was drinking the Kirkland version. But I had 8 bottles of it left. So I slowly, basically, would drink half a bottle a day until it was gone. It took about 14 days or so. And I haven't gone back to the doctor yet to get it cleared, but I've basically, for the most part, not drinking any caffeine for the last 5 or 6 weeks now. And it took me the first 2 days. I got a headache. But the whole point of that story is we'll have a little idol in our life, and we think, well, it's not doing that much damage. I still feel like I'm walking close to God. I still feel like I'm still going to church. But that idol does damage that we sometimes don't see. But it takes in looking to the word of the great physician to go, hey, there's a problem here. And that's when you realize, okay, I need to take care of this. And that's when I got that physical, I went, oh, great, I have a problem. So I had to fix that problem. So as we're going through this, God may bring things to your mind where you're like, that might be an idol. Maybe I need to check my heart about this. And then if you find out that it is, then you need to cut it out because it's going to damage your walk. So I have other examples here of ways that I screwed up, but I won't go into those yet. Okay, so now we're the son. Like I said, I think he's a mama's boy. But I see two immediate issues with him in these 6 verses. One is he had a bad motive for confession. When you look, he doesn't do what's right because he fears judgment. His heart's not right. He just fears the consequences. And so often we think, well, it's not wrong if I don't get caught. And how many times have we heard that in our society? In fact, we've joked about that a lot at work. Well, I know I did that. Costco has a specific way of doing things. We merchandise things a certain way. We're not allowed to have end caps a certain height or different way we merch things. And sometimes it's like, you know what, I don't have time, or I don't think I have time. I'm just going to cheat a little. And I go, well, if they don't notice it, it's not really wrong, is it? And they have this other mantra I learned from a previous pastor. It's easier to ask forgiveness than permission. And so I'll usually justify that. But, you know, we try to, if we fear the consequences, usually that's when we're going to admit our failure. Now, like I said, this guy's heart was not right. And many times in Israel's history, it wasn't just their religion, it wasn't their religious services that God didn't like. It was the heart behind it. And so God is looking for the heart. It would be no different if, I mean, we're all here today. Do we all come with the heart to learn, or do we come because it's tradition, or, well, I don't want someone to say anything because I didn't show up. A lot of times people are afraid of the call from somebody. Hey, I didn't see you in church today. So sometimes we're afraid of that. We just want to double check our heart in each situation that we're in. Now, the second thing is the making of images. And this is obviously a blatant breaking of the second commandment. It has, however, been suggested that, well, maybe he was making these images to replicate what was in the Holy of Holies, such as the Ark of the Covenant. People, some commentators think, well, it could be he was making a replica of, you know, the cherubim on top, and maybe there was a little golden altar or whatever like they have in the tabernacle. But even if he did that, he's still imitating what God said to do. He's not doing the right thing. He's doing what his own heart wants to do. So even if it was meant to represent God, it wouldn't have been okay. He's trying to justify his means. He would be trying to justify his means by what he was doing. Now, also in this first five verses, I think it's instructive that he actually breaks six of the Ten Commandments. He breaks the fifth one, honor thy father and mother. He breaks the eighth one, thou shalt not steal. He broke the ninth one, thou shalt not lie, or she, his mother did. The mother lied about giving all the silver to the Lord. The tenth commandment, thou shalt not covet. The son stole because of coveting what his mother had. And according to Ephesians 5, covetousness is idolatry. He broke the second commandment, don't make any graven image. And he broke the third commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, which according to Proverbs 39, if you're stealing and you're caught, you're basically profaning or taking in vain the name of the Lord. So he broke six commandments in six verses. And again, I'm not being nitpicky or condemning, but I think it's interesting that they kind of did it all without any thought of repercussion. There wasn't any sense of wrongdoing by either of them, except for when he said, oh, okay, it was me. That then he had a sense because he thought, oh, I got caught. And I think this is where it imitates us today. The reason that they weren't shocked by sinning, it was so commonplace. And in America, it is commonplace everywhere. I mean, when I'm at work, and we all work with non-Christians, most of us, when they do things that are definitely not godly, it's like, okay, well, I hear this every day, so we kind of get used to it. And so when we watch movies, we're like, oh, I hear that every day at work, so it's not a big deal. So we kind of become desensitized to it. And my wife and I went to the theater on Friday night for yesterday was our 11th anniversary, by the way. And We went to the movies and dinner for our anniversary, and we watched the movie The Giver. I think that was the first night it came out. We didn't really know anything about it, but it was about a society that basically said, oh, all the passions of humanity are sinful and we gotta get rid of them all, and everybody take an injection to suppress your emotions and stuff like that. Actually, my wife said it was my kind of movie because she said I don't have any emotions. But I'm just kidding. Anyway, in this society, though, they had changed the names of death. They had made it seem like death was not a big deal. So they said, oh, we don't have any violence, we don't have any death, we don't have any this. They would call the passing of old people going to elsewhere. Or they had another term for it, for babies. But they were basically killing them and saying they've graduated to elsewhere or somewhere else. And they had become desensitized to it. They didn't realize what they were doing because it was so commonplace. And that's our society. We do things so commonplace now that sin is not that big of a deal. Until we're out there and then we come and we look at God's word and we go, oh, that was bad. I need to be more sensitive to that. And I, like I said, I find myself very calloused to things around me because there are quite a few Christians at my work, but there are a lot of people who are not, and they have no problem using colorful language. And I find myself desensitized to that, unfortunately. The good thing is, my wife is very sensitive to those things. So we could be watching something on TV, and I don't realize something's wrong. She goes, you know what, we shouldn't watch this because of such and such. And I go, oh, you're right, and so we'll change the channel. And so I'm glad that she is, I don't want to say overly sensitive, but as sensitive as she should be to those things, because it helps keep me where I should be. Now, Micah had a shrine. Now, he's going to do four things here that are the do-it-yourself religion. The first thing is, he had a shrine. Now, the purpose of a shrine, it was sort of a small temple in your house, a place where others could come and worship these idols as well, not just your family. And so, basically, he had his own little holy of holies set up in his house so that he didn't have to travel to Shiloh. Shiloh was the place where the tabernacle of meeting was set up. You had to go two or three times a year. It was part of the law to make your sacrifices to God. What he did was he set up his own shrine so he didn't have to go. Second thing he did was he made an ephod. And the purpose of the ephod was it was the clothing worn by the priest. And in Exodus 28, God says, I want the priest to wear this so that he can minister before me. So it was an outfit worn for the priesthood, but Micah, having imitated the tabernacle, now imitates priestly garments. And then he takes household gods, places them in that shrine, and it wasn't just the two that his mother gave him. He had, it sounds like, dozens that he had in there. It doesn't give us specifics. But if you remember when Pastor Bill went to Cambodia, he took pictures, and they had these little household shrines, and they had these little idols. Imagine that only in a Canaanite context, I guess. Just those kind of gods. That's what he had in his house. The fourth thing is he installed one of his sons as his priest. And anybody who was not from the family of Aaron was prohibited from being a priest in Israel. I think something else that's interesting about this is he said his son is priest. Now, the priest is someone who's supposed to give spiritual guidance to the people. And so he sets up his younger son in a position of power over him, and yet, or which should have been, but basically what he's doing is controlling the priest, controlling his son so he doesn't have to feel bad or convicted about anything God might say, because he can say, look, son, I know you're the priest, but I'm your father, so you can't do that. You can't say this kind of things to me. So he's basically controlling his religion, controlling what can be said against him. So Micah basically does everything he can to set up a rival religion in Israel. But it's a rival religion in a sense where he's not worshiping Canaanite gods. He's actually saying, God, I want to worship you, but I want to worship you my way. Your name is still behind it. Because he's there. When you look in the text, it has Lord in all capital letters, which means it's YHWH. So he's trying to serve the Lord in his own way. He's not following God as God has said. He's following God as he feels like he should. And we actually do the same thing. We don't follow God's standards always like we should. We go, well, God, I know you said to do that, but it'd be so much better if I could do it this way. And that's what he did. That's what we do. And if you look in 2 Timothy chapter 4, it actually says that the church is going to be that way. People are going to look for teachers that tickle their ears, that make them feel good about following God. The emergent church is a good example of that. They kind of toss out the Bible and follow tradition and lower the lights and have candles to make you feel super spiritual. And there's different things like that that people will do to, well, do we really need the word? Can we just follow God our way? I want to feel good about going to church. I don't want to feel convicted. And that's a lot of times the standard in some churches. And I'm not defining all churches that way at all, but there are places where people go because they want to feel good. They don't want to feel conviction. Now, I'm going to give you a picture of how God views this idolatry. Now, imagine an old photograph of you that you wouldn't like to get public. There's one of me, but I'm not going to tell you about it. Now, it's a terrible thing when a photograph does not give you justice. And I think everybody has seen one of those of themselves where they're like, oh, you're going to tear that one up. I know I hear people all the time, oh, it's usually girls too. They tear it up. I don't like the way it looks. I look at that angle or in that skirt or whatever. But in a sense, that's kind of like idolatry in a lesser sense, because God is spirit. We have to worship him in spirit and truth. But when we take him and we say, I want to put these standards on you, we take that picture of God and we twist it so it's not the picture it should be. You could also imagine it being, let's say someone takes a picture of some person in an ad and they say, hey, that's Eric. Like, that's not Eric. Actually, that might be a better thing because I might look like a model instead. But it would be a false image. That's not me. And it's the same thing with God. They make these images and they say, oh, that's not you, God. Or we'd say, that's not God, but we try to twist him and put him in an image that we like. And that's what idolatry is. Now, when we look at idolatry to us personally, and names are a big thing in the Bible. When I name all my kids, I'm looking for biblical names, and I'm looking at their meanings, and I like what the meanings mean. Micah is a derivative of Michael, and it can either mean there is none like the Lord or a hypothetical question, who is like the Lord? And the answer is nobody. So his name is basically one that seems like he should be serving God with all his heart. Now, we call ourselves Christian, which is little Christ or follower of Christ. And we could seem to be verbally and externally following Christ, and yet there could be an idol in our heart that no one else sees. So we could be following in a hypocritical sense. Now, there are other people who would read this text that would say, well, Micah does kind of have an excuse. I mean, you got to think, Shiloh was basically in the center of Israel, and Israel was more long than it was wide. So we have Israel up here, Israel down here, and those people would have to travel and sacrifice monetarily and time at work and stuff like that to travel to do those sacrifices. You would say, well, I mean, doesn't it make sense that he should, you know, save money and you know, not have to spend the expense? But in the Word, sacrifice always comes at expense. We should never be sacrificing what doesn't cost us anything. In the book of Malachi, they were doing this. They were saying, you know what, don't give God the best one. Give him that lame one. That one's going to die anyway. And that's what they were doing. So there, Micah, in a sense, was saying, I don't really want to travel. I mean, I don't really want to go that far. It's kind of an inconvenience. And we might say some things, you know, God said, commands us to do this or that. And we say, it's kind of an inconvenience. I don't really want to do that. But this excuse actually doesn't work for Micah. Micah lives in the mountains of Ephraim. Shiloh was in the mountains of Ephraim. It was probably at most a few days' journey for him to go there, so it wasn't that much of an expense. So he kind of doesn't have an excuse, but those excuses come up. God, it's kind of an inconvenience. I don't want to do that because we have this idol that our convenience is the idol. It's usually, like I said, we want to come to God on our terms instead of coming to him on his terms. Verses 7 and 8. A young Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, who had been living within the clan of Judah, left that town in search of some other place to stay. On his way, he came to Micah's house in the hill country of Ephraim. In the book of Joshua, the Levites were given 48 cities to live and minister in. Now, the Levites, they were the ones who took care of the tabernacle, and later they took care of the temple. And they all rotated their service each month to serve in that capacity. When they weren't serving there, they were basically there to serve and minister in the cities that they were sent to live in. This Levite, however, decides he doesn't want to do that. Now, I'm wondering why he would leave the city. And the text doesn't say specifically, but I'm going to suggest something, and this is my opinion, but it seems like it fits considering the rest of the two chapters. and that is compromise. He had cities to live in. He had a place where God had established for him to minister, and yet he was wandering, looking for a place to stay. Now, I don't know if he was wandering from God. I don't know if he just didn't want the ministry that God had given him. I don't know if he just wanted to wander from his purpose. He didn't like it. But we only wander when we lack or we try to avoid the direction or purpose God has in our life. Now, each of us has a purpose and a direction that God has given us, and if we're not following it, it's usually because there is some idol in our life keeping us from that. There's a motto that one of my youth pastors gave me a long time ago, and it was, idle time, I-D-L-E, is idle time, I-D-O-L, where if we're not following the purpose that God has given us, we usually leave a hole in our life for us to kind of go after an idol or fantasize about some idol. Oh, I'd really love to eat pumpkin pie or something like that. But we can deviate when we give ourselves the idle time. And not that we need to be constantly busy like Martha doing everything and constantly busy, but we should have time where we shouldn't have time where we're just sitting around going, huh, what am I going to do today? And then that's when Satan comes like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. He's like, oh, their guard is down. What can I do to get them to fall? Now, I think the way to prevent that is to keep your mission on the forefront of your mind. Now, obviously, the Christian mission is to make disciples of all nations. But because God has given us each spiritual gifts, he's given us different ways to accomplish that goal. So if you know what your gift is, then you focus on that and you say, okay, God, and this is what I do. When I get up in the morning, or what I try to do consistently is, okay, God, when I go to work today, who are you going to put in my path and prepare my heart for what could come about? Because I don't know what's going to come. So I try to get in the Word, and I try to do my devotions, and I try to make sure I pray. And I'm not always as consistent as I should be, but I like to prepare for what that mission is. So you got to ask yourself, what's your mission? And when you get up each morning, are you thinking, I got to do this, this, and this? Or are you thinking, okay, Lord, through everything I have to do today, keep my mind sharp and focused on the mission? And again, it could be different things. You could run a company. You could be a laborer shoveling dirt. You could be like my wife. Her mission each day is to homeschool the children to start with, and to minister to the children so that hopefully, we believe in birth evangelism, that's why we have so many kids. We figure if we can just do that. But that's one of our goals is to expand the kingdom of God by training our children correctly so that hopefully they will go out. But that's how we prepare each day, is by trying to do those things. And we have family devotions that hopefully will accomplish that. But we just have to make sure that we keep the mission and purpose at the forefront so that we can keep doing that. Otherwise, that idle time turns into idols that we follow. Verses 9 through 13. Micah asked him, "Where are you from?" "I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah," he said, "and I am looking for a place to stay." Then Micah said to him, "Live with me and be my father and priest, and I'll give you 10 shekels of silver, your clothes, and your food." This gives you a picture of how much 1,100 shekels was. He's going to give him 10 shekels a year for employment. So if his mother had 1,100 shekels, they were pretty well off. So the Levite agreed to live with him, and the young man became like one of his sons. Then Micah installed the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in his house. And Micah said, "Now I know the Lord will be good to me, since this Levite has become my priest." Now, remember what I said before about him installing his son so he could control his son so he doesn't have to feel, you know, bad about being directed by God? He'd say, "Hey, look, son, I'm your dad. I should know better." Well, he talks to this Levite who is evidently younger, it seems. It says young man. He says, "Live with me and be my father and priest, and I'll give you 10 shekels of silver." Yet if we go down to, where is it? Verse 11, it says, so the Levite agreed, and the young man became like one of his sons. So again, someone he can possibly direct and control so he doesn't have to feel bad about it. So he hasn't really changed anything, but he is trying to legitimize what he's been doing. Now, this Levite's idol, it seems, is he wanted more than God had for him. He wanted what he thought was better. He was seeking a better place. He was seeking a better opportunity. Now, it seems like he was very discontent. And just as it says in 1 Timothy, godliness with contentment brings great gain, the opposite is also true. Discontentment can breed ungodliness, and that can lead to a great spiritual loss in our lives if we're discontent with where God has put us. Even if that brings us financial gain or power or prosperity. So discontent. So discontentment with your circumstances is idolatry as well. And I think it's also interesting that the Levite has no problem selling out his position for security at Micah's house. What he should have done as a minister of God is warn Micah that what he was doing was idolatry, but he didn't do that. So he had a price for compromise. And I've told you about some of the funnier things that have been in my life that I've put as idols, and there have been more serious things where I go, well, what's the price of my godliness? What's the price of my family? What's the price of idolatry? And this guy's price was, I want a good life. Not that it's wrong to have that, but it's wrong if it's not what God has put for you at that moment. Paul himself had great times. Paul himself had times where he's all, I've been in want. Yet he learned to be content through all that. But like I said, it looks like he was seeking a better place. He was looking for a better opportunity. But if you look in Hebrews chapter 13, they use the word better there too. It says Abraham was looking for a better country. Abraham was looking for a better place. The better was heaven. He was looking at the heavenly city. He saw the goal afar off. This Levite, he had the outlook. He was looking around him. He didn't have the uplook. He wasn't looking at the heavenly goals and principles. So I believe each week, maybe each day, we should do a searching as we do our devotions and say, where is my heart? Do I have a price? Lord, take that price away from me so that we don't stumble. Now, like I said, it looks like when he says, now I know that the Lord will be good to me since this Levite has become my priest. It looks like he's legitimizing it. He's trying to make it so that, well, you know what, it was my son, and that wasn't really from the line of the Levites. But this Levite, he takes care of the temple. If I have him, that makes what I'm doing even better. And I think a lot of times we try to legitimize why an idol should be in our life. There was at one point when I was just graduated high school, and I, up until recently, have always been in pretty decent shape. I was in high school. I walked to and from school, and I lived 4 miles away from school. And my first period in my senior year, at least, was weightlifting. And so I lifted weights for a whole year, and we had to run a mile in 6 minutes or under to get an A in the class, and we had to do all these things, and I got an A in the class, so I was in good shape. And I would go home, and what's ironic was I was still doing devotions this whole time. I was very, very consistent in my latter 2 years of high school and reading the Bible every day, and I had read through the Bible at least once by that time. And so I was doing those things, but I'd go home after walking 4 miles, maybe do a half hour, an hour of homework. I put forth very little effort in high school, unfortunately. And I would exercise for the next 2.5 hours at home, even though I'd already walked 8 miles that day, even though I'd already done weightlifting, even though I'd already done all those things, I would exercise even more because physical fitness and that kind of thing was a major priority in my life. And it was up until, I want to say I was 25 or so. And I knew it. I went to a summer camp right after high school. And God was like, this is your idol. And I said, no, it's not. I said, how am I going to reach those other people who are physically fit if I'm not physically fit too? And so I was trying to justify why I was doing things. And I would buy muscle and fitness. And I would buy men's health. And I'd go, oh, look at this article. Look what Bruce Lee was doing. I could do that. And I was like, just trying to justify. And I'd be like, hey, I'm sharing with so-and-so about muscle and fitness, and I'm going to weasel God in there somehow. And that's what we do. Whatever it is, we go, I don't want to let that go because I'm going to use it for God's glory somehow. And God may use it here and there, but it's not going to be completely useful because it's that idol that sticks up in our heart that's holding on. And they're hard to let go. But we try to legitimize it, and that's what he's doing here. Chapter 18. Chapter 18 is an example of tribal idolatry as a whole. Now we went from personal, we saw the mother and the son, they had personal idolatry, to family idolatry. And now we're going to tribal idolatry, or the community. And eventually that's going to extend to the nation farther in their future. And you can see these processes in our country today. We used to be more of a godly nation. But we've let little idols creep in, and those things affect the family. And then the family as a whole affects the vote and affects where we're going. Now, chapter 17 and 18 is this progression. In chapter 19, you can see how this idolatry affects morality, because there's a city in Benjamin, I believe it's Gibeah, that is given to sodomy and rape. And that's where Israel progressed to. And you can see this progression of where the idols lead. I'm going to read verse 1 of chapter 18. In those days, Israel had no king. That's actually a lie. God was their king. And it says so many times in the Old Testament. But according to their human standard, they did not. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking a place of their own where they might settle, because they had not yet come into an inheritance among the tribes of Israel. There's a reason for that. They don't want to work for it. God allowed the Canaanites to be fearsome, and they were a hard people to drive out. Now, the tribes that relied on God and said, God, what do you want us to do? When do you want us to go? And they would cast lot and ask God when they wanted to do things. Who should go up first? So some of these tribes would ask God, how do you want us to do it? And those tribes succeeded. Dan did not. They succeeded partially. Part of the tribe of Dan actually did succeed. And actually, Samson was from the tribe of Dan, and part of the area that he was in did overcome the Philistines. Others did not. But they had powerful neighbors, and it was hard, and it was difficult, and they were struggling. And they went, this is too hard. So they wanted something a little easier. Now, I think, and I mentioned this in Home Fellowship a couple weeks ago, we need the struggle. We need to struggle to love God. In the book of Joshua, Caleb was a man who relied on God. Now, just as Abraham didn't go, oh, that valley over there is lush and green, I'm going to take that lot, you take that, he gave a lot of choice. And Abraham took the harsh and the barren wilderness, and Abraham relied on God, and Abraham prospered. Caleb was the same way. He didn't look for the easy way out. I've been I've told some people this. I've been doing devotions in the morning, going through this devotional by Henry Blackaby called Experiencing God Day by Day. And one of the devotions on August 3rd is about Caleb. Let me read it. I'm going to read you a blurb. I didn't write the whole thing down. Caleb longed to see God work in power, and he knew he would be less likely to rely on God if he dwelt in the easy places. He chose a situation in which he would have to trust in God. Caleb knew his inheritance from God was on the mountain. He refused to allow the difficulty of gaining it to stop him from enjoying all that God had promised him. If you always choose the easy way, asking for the peaceful valleys, you will never see God's power displayed to enable you to take a mountain. Seek out the mountains, and you will witness God doing things through your life that can be explained only by his mighty presence. And I thought that was great, because so often we don't like to struggle. I don't like to struggle. Later on we realize the struggle was worth what we gained from it, but during it we're like, this is lame. I don't want to do this. I don't want to struggle. God, can't you just give me what I want so I don't have to do this? But if he did that, we wouldn't have to rely on him. We wouldn't have to lean on him each day. And so this struggle is good. Dan, they didn't want the struggle. I'll talk more about Dan in a second, but they just wanted the easy way. They didn't grow in their faith as much as some of the other tribes did. Judah was one of the tribes that conquered, I believe, everything that God had given them. And there were a few tribes that did. Dan was not that fortunate. But we need to ask ourselves if we want to grow in our faith. If someone says something difficult for us to hear, do we move on because we don't like it, or do we take to heart what the scripture says, which is, in Proverbs, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. Friends are willing to hurt you for your betterment and your growth in the faith. All too often our Christian attitude is, who are you going to judge? Or who are you to judge? Instead of saying, thank you for that, I will have to pray about that, that the Lord will remove it from my life. A lot of times we don't do that. And Dan didn't want the struggle. We don't want the struggle. Sometimes you may hear me or someone say something in a church you're attending, you're like, I don't like that. I'm going. And it's very easy in America to do that. But I've been confronted many times before about things I have said. And initially, and I'm assuming all guys are stubborn and it's not just me. Initially, I'm usually like, it's not true. I don't care. I don't want to hear it. And I'll leave. The good thing is, that's only what's going on the outside, because I hate being confronted, as I think most of us do. Usually, I'm introspective and I go back and I'm thinking about it and I'm praying about it and I go, okay, I was wrong. I was sinning against that person. So that I will go back and I will apologize. There's other people, and I've done the same thing to people. I've confronted some people, and they said, you know what? That really hit me, and it hurt, but I appreciated that you were willing to do that. Other people have said, you don't even know what you're talking about. You must stop talking right now, because I'm not going to listen. My wife has tried to talk to people who are Christians and pastors, and they go, I don't want to talk to you, and the pastor will close his ears and walk away. And there are people like that. But we need to be willing to listen to things that are hard, because that's how we're going to grow, and that's how God uses us, or uses people to grow in our lives, in our faith. I am almost done, I promise. Let me read chapter 18, and then I'll sum it up. So the Danites sent five of their leading men from Zorah and Eshtaol to spy out the land and explore it. These men represented all the Danites. They told them, go, explore the land. So they entered the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah, where they spent the night. When they were near Micah's house, they recognized the voice of the young man, the young Levite. So they turned in there and asked him, who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? Why are you here? He told them that what Micah had done for him, and said, he has hired me and I am his priest. Then they said to him, please inquire of God to learn whether our journey will be successful. The priest answered them, go in peace, your journey has the Lord's approval. It doesn't seem like he asked God there, does it? Verse 7. So the five men left and came to Laish, where they saw the people were living in safety, like the Sidonians, at peace and secure. And since their land lacked nothing, they were prosperous. Also, they lived a long way from the Sidonians and had no relationship with anyone else. When they returned to Zorah and Eshtaol, their fellow Danites asked them, "How did you find things?" They answered, "Come, let's attack them. We have seen the land, and it is very good. Aren't you going to do something? Don't hesitate to go there and take it over. When you get there, you will find an unsuspecting people and a spacious land that God has put into your hands, a land that lacks nothing whatsoever." Then 600 men of the Danites, armed for battle, set out for Zorah and Eshtaol. On their way, they set up camp near Kirjath-Jearim in Judah. This is why the place west of Kiriath-Jearim is called Mahana Dan to this day. From there they went on to the hill country of Ephraim and came to Micah's house. Then the five men who had spied out the land of Laish said to their fellow Danites, "Do you know that one of these houses has an ephod, some household gods, and an image overlaid with silver? Now you know what to do." So they turned in there and went to the house of the young Levite at Micah's place and greeted him. The 600 Danites, armed for battle, stood at the entrance of the gate. The five men who had spied out the land went inside and took the idol, the ephod, and the household gods, while the priest and 600 men armed stood at the entrance of the gate. When the five men went into Micah's house and took the idol, the ephod, and the household gods, the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" They answered him, "Be quiet, don't say a word. Come with us and be our father and priest. Isn't it better that you serve a tribe and clan instead of in Israel as a priest rather than just one man's household?" The priest was very pleased. He took the ephod, the household gods, and the idol and went along with the people. Putting their little children, their livestock, and their possessions in front of them, they turned away and left. When they had gone some distance from Micah's house, the men who lived near Micah were called together and overtook the Danites. As they shouted after him, the Danites turned and said to Micah, "What's the matter with you that you called out your men to fight?" He replied, "You took the gods I made and my priest and went away. What else do I have? How can you ask, 'What's the matter with you?'" The Danites answered, "Don't argue with us, or some of the men may get angry and attack you, and you and your family will lose your lives." So the Danites went their way, and Micah, seeing that they were too strong for him, turned around and went back home. Then they took what Micah had made and his priest and went to Laish against the people at peace and secure. They attacked them with the sword and burned down their city. There was no one to rescue them because they had lived a long way from Sidon and had no relationship with anyone else. The city was in a valley near Beth Rehob. The Danites rebuilt the city and settled there. They named it Dan after their ancestor Dan, who was born in Israel, though the city used to be called Laish. There the Danites set up for themselves the idol, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests for the tribe of Dan until the time of the captivity of the land. Okay. Verse 31. They continued to use the idol Micah had made all the time the house of God was in Shiloh. There's a lot here, but I'm just going to say a few things. One is, he was robbed of all his idols, things he put his heart after, and they were taken from him, and he was left with emptiness. He was left with nothing. And that's the same thing that happens when we pursue any idol in our life instead of God. When they're taken away, we feel we have nothing. But the good thing is, if we're not following us, but we're following God, we have everything, because God can never be taken away from us. We will never be able to jump out of his hand, or he'll never lose us from his grasp. But that's not what he was following. He was left with nothing. Now, there's three quick things. There's an attitude. Our attitude is, what is our attitude in the service of Christ? Are we looking for a place? A place where we can assert ourselves? Are we looking for prestige or privilege like this Levite was? Because he went from, this is where I think he was an opportunist. He went from a household to, hey, I'm going to be pastor or a priest for an entire tribe. That's better than this little household. So he asserts himself and goes to the bigger. The second thing is the effects that it has on those around us. I don't think Micah had any idea how far-reaching the effects of his sin really were. And a lot of times we don't see that. We're blinded to the ripple effect that our sin has to those around us. Our attitude has that effect. Our sin has that effect. And then there's our goals, what we're pursuing. What standard of conduct do we live by? We've seen the conduct of all these people. Sin was so commonplace, it didn't even seem like sin. And I think this is where we always need a fresh call each day to devote ourselves to God and His Word, to remember what He's done to motivate us and to think of His return, because that's what should really motivate us. Because He could come at any moment. And the last thing is treasure. People look for something better. And they look around themselves, not just at power and prestige, but what can I grasp as far as money? In 2 Timothy chapter 2, it says, "If we suffer with Him, we shall also reign with Him. If we deny Him, He also will deny us." And if all we're living for, if our idol is material things, we are going to lose out one day. It's not that we won't go to heaven, because if we're truly saved, we will. But we're not going to have the treasure in heaven that we should. There was a pastor named George Truett, who was a longtime pastor of First Baptist Church in Dallas. He was invited to dinner at the home of a wealthy oil tycoon. And after dinner, they went up onto a balcony of the house, and the tycoon pointed out to the west, and he said, "See all those oil fields? Those are mine." And he pointed to the other way, whatever that is. He said, "See all that? All that land is mine." And he turned to the other side and he said, "All that is mine too." And so he's expecting a congratulations from the pastor. And he puts his hand on his shoulder and he says, "How much of that is yours?" And he points to heaven. So, reflect today. If there's an idol in our life, is it controlling you? Is it preventing you from getting the treasure in heaven that you should have? And is it keeping you from the goal that God has for your life? And so, as John said in the last verse of 1 John, "My little children, keep yourself from idols." Let's pray. Lord, I do thank You for the privilege of serving You in everything. And I know that idols can be destructive in our lives, and they hurt us, and they tear us down. And a lot of times we don't even realize it. And they can keep us from our goals, and they can keep us from the best that You have for our life. I do pray, Lord, that You would stay center stage in our life, that You would be on the throne of our life, and that nothing would distract us from serving You. So that when we get to heaven, You can say, "Well done, my good and faithful servant. Enter into Your rest." Thank You for this morning. Thank You for all those who are here. I pray that You would bless them. In Jesus' name, amen.